Let's, you copy me? Okay, let's get started. We'll follow the same procedure as we have on previous sessions. If we could start from the far right for this, the lunar chemistry session, and have each gentleman identify himself and his affiliation, and then perhaps discuss in about 2 minutes the nature of his presentation this morning, and then we'll throw it open for questions. We'll start with Dr. Taylor.
Ross Taylor, Australian National University. My own impression of the session on chemistry this morning is the general confirmation of the, in the general level, of the PET results, showing the depletion in volatile elements, the depletion in the nickel and the platinum group elements, the elements which enter a metal phase, the general enrichment in the refractory elements of zirconium, titanium, yttrium, and rare earths in the samples, and also the fact that... I'm sorry, is this... Oh. Yeah. Is this working all right? The significant things, I think, in a general way, are the overall depletion compared with cosmic abundances or some terrestrial abundances, the depletion in the volatile elements, the depletion in the elements which enter a metal phase, that is nickel, the platinum group elements, these elements are low in the lunar rocks, the refractory elements, titanium, zirconium, and so on, are enriched. And this confirms in a general way the PET chemical data. A final comment that this chemistry is very distinct from tektites. We see no evidence of a chemistry resembling tektites.
My name is Stan Epstein. I'm from Caltech. I'm one of the people who spoke on stable isotope variation in lunar rocks. As you know, or as you might not know, the isotopic variations of stable isotopes like 18 to 16, C13 to C12 reflect processes, fractionations. You can measure temperature by measuring the isotopic composition among various lunar materials, lunar minerals, and the impression that I got from these data is that there's a great similarity between the Earth and the Moon. That is, the oxygen, which is a major element, the silicon, which is a major element, is isotopically very similar to the igneous rocks on the Moon. In addition, there was some work that I had some to do with was on the measuring the deuterium concentration and the hydrogen that's present in the Moon. And from that, we try to learn something about the solar wind. In addition, there's the remote possibility that there may be some water present on the Moon, and there's a possibility that the deuterium to hydrogen ratio may indicate its presence or absence. The impression I got from the data is that the possibility of having even minute amounts of water is quite remote, that the hydrogen that we were able to extract from the lunar rocks was primarily solar wind hydrogen. Now, we have not eliminated as yet the possibility of minute traces of hydrogen which may be inherent in the composition of the Moon, and that there's still a possibility of that. And I think some careful sampling, future sampling of the lunar surface is in order to settle this problem.
Robert Clayton, University of Chicago. Our work deals with oxygen isotopes and in that way overlaps with a part of what Dr. Epstein discussed this morning. Our applications were in three areas. One, that of thermometry, that is the estimate, a quantitative estimate of the temperature of crystallization of the lunar igneous rocks. And we quoted a value of a little over 1100 degrees C. And in this, we find these rocks to be indistinguishable from terrestrial volcanic rocks such as those in Hawaii, where we have very comparable measurements. So this just is a further confirmation that what the petrologists have recognized for a long time, that these are volcanic rocks. Secondly, in the relationship of isotopic composition to other objects in the solar system, which Dr. Epstein mentioned, there are, among the meteorites, various meteorite classes which have distinctive oxygen isotope abundances. The abundance on the moon is quite different from some of those meteorite classes, and in particular, a couple of classes which some people had thought are derived from the moon. The lunar compositions are distinctly different, and I would say this makes it quite unlikely that these groups, particularly the so-called basaltic achondrites, quite unlikely that they have been derived from the moon. Third point deals with the relationship of the soil to the lunar rocks. Our analyses of the small fragments of rock which are found in the soil are quite identical with the analyses of oxygen isotopes in the larger rocks, so there seems to be nothing mysterious about the small fragments. They are just broken off from the large ones. However, the glassy spherules are distinctively different in their isotopic composition, suggesting either that they have acquired material from either some different part of the moon or from outside the moon, as maybe we may be seeing some sort of meteoritic contribution, or possibly this difference may be a result of the process which makes the spherules themselves. If so, this probably represents some very high temperature melting process.
Well, I'm Harold Urey from University of California. I was chairman this morning and didn't present any paper at all. And I would say that the only way I got into it was in part of the discussion in regard to how we could get a highly differentiated moon. This was brought up by my friend Schmidt here, isn't that right? Yes. I would only say that during the last years, I have talked about lava flows on the moon, and I've talked about water on the moon. I have thought that these smooth areas on the moon might be lava flows, and I've thought also that they might be old lake beds. I don't believe they're either one. I believe none of us have seen anything of this sort. What we've seen is some fine dust that isn't made by any process that we know of on Earth, and interpreted a fine dust layer as perhaps a smooth lava flow or a smooth old lake bed or something of the sort. And I think all of us, if we are right down frankly honest, will admit that we have been wrong about this. And in particular, apparently there is no surface water been present on the moon at all. That's my conclusion at present anyway. Of course, the rocks that we're looking at were once melted. That is true. And in that sense, perhaps the people that talk about lava flows have a right to do so. But what we've looked at has been a smooth dust plane that apparently is not made by any processes that we see on the Earth. And the second thing is that if this layer on the surface of the moon is thick, this differentiated layer, it is proved that the entire moon must have been highly differentiated to produce it. I do not think we have proven that. I think we'll have to have much more evidence before we know how thick this layer is. And in particular, I would like to urge that we ought to send one of the Apollo missions right to the center of one of the big collision maria, if we possibly can, in order to see what the composition is at the center of such a big maria and not depend entirely upon the thin edges, which are the places that are scheduled to be visited by Apollo at the present time. Well, this is the only way, other side of calling names and announcing titles, that I've been connected with this.
My name is Roman Schmidt from Oregon State University. We've measured some over 30 elements, chemical elements, and includes the major elements, minor elements, and trace elements, using the technique of activation analysis, which simply means using a nuclear reactor to determine how many chemical elements and how much of each chemical element is present in a given rock or in the dust. Now, some of our findings, I think, can be encapsulated as follows, and these are, of course, in agreement with what other investigators have found, that these breccia rocks, which have been found, can be compacted from lunar soil. This has been well substantiated, I think, by many investigators here. Secondly, the 14 rare earth elements, which are very coherent in their chemical properties, are enriched by a factor of about 60 compared to the ordinary chondritic meteorites. That's the garden variety meteorite, which you would probably pick up if it would fall on the earth. And thirdly, the distribution, that is the relative concentrations of these 14 rare earth elements, are very, very similar to those, the same elements which they find in these abyssal basalts on the ocean bottoms. Now, if you make an assumption that the moon originally had the composition of a chondritic meteorite, and Professor Urey could elaborate on this for hours, if you assume that originally had this composition, and if it was all melted, then the conclusion is, under certain assumptions, that the heavy elements like the rare earths and barium and thorium and uranium would float to the top, and under other assumptions, this would give you a crust of 9 kilometers. That's about 5 or 6 miles thick. On the other hand, if the original moon was composed of a rare type of a meteorite, originally called a calcium rich achondrite, eucrites, then the crust would increase to something like 60 miles thick or so forth. The fourth finding is that we've looked at the composition of the soil and the core tubes, and we find that there are apparently heterogeneities, differences in the composition. The core tube was sampled by the Lunar Receiving Laboratory at about 1-inch intervals from the surface down to 4 inches, and we apparently find, and other data is, of course, necessary to confirm this, which is now in the data reduction process, is there seem to be 10 to 20% differences in elements such as calcium, titanium, and sodium. What this would imply, if these are borne out by further analysis, is that if the dust was thrown out from the lunar highland impacts, then the lunar highlands are probably also have some degree of heterogeneity, which I think most of us could agree on.
My name is Smales. I come from the Harwell Research Establishment in England. What we've been doing is to apply quite a variety of analytical methods to the problem of determining the elemental composition of the lunar material. We've not only used the Harwell reactors, but we've used the Harwell linear accelerators and a wide variety of instruments that we have available in the analytical sciences division there. In addition to analyzing the moon itself, we've analyzed one of the spherules, the glass spheres that was found amongst the material that was isolated by Dr. Agrell, a colleague of mine at Cambridge. And the analysis shows that it is quite similar to the broad lunar material. There seems to be some depletion in the sphere of the alkali metals, and one might be interested to speculate that it could be a molten droplet formed by a meteorite impact on the surface material, and one would like to draw the analogy between that and the tektites, which I personally believe are terrestrial in origin on the Earth. We've also compared the lunar material with the unique meteorite, Angra dos Reis. This is the only one of its class amongst the meteorites. The rare earth contents, which Dr. Schmidt has mentioned, has talked about, in the Angra Dos Reis meteorite are about half the level, broadly speaking, that they are in the lunar material, and that is the closest agreement in absolute level of any material that I think has been talked about so far. However, the resemblance fades after that, and the alkali metal situation in that particular meteorite is completely different from the lunar material. So we have not yet found absolute agreement between anything and the lunar material, if one goes into great detail.
I'm George Weatherall from UCLA. I wasn't a speaker this morning. I was co-chairman with Professor Urey, so I really shouldn't have a whole lot to say. I just might mention one thing. Much of this chemical evidence, as has been mentioned by the speakers, bears directly on the question of differentiation and fractionation within the moon. And there are some other elements besides the rare earths which are greatly enriched in the lunar surface, and which are different from rare earths in that we can quite strictly rule out the fact that the entire moon is enriched in these elements. And these are the radioactive elements uranium and thorium. If uranium and thorium had anything like their surface concentration in the interior of the moon, the whole moon would still be melted at the present time. This does not occur, and therefore this enrichment in the moon seems to be, at least in some sense, a fractionation within the moon, rather than say the whole moon being enriched in certain elements, or even a very large part of the moon. Also, I think that it can be shown that the basaltic composition cannot extend very deep into the interior of the moon because of the fact that at sufficiently high pressures, the basalt will be transformed into an eclogite, which will result in an overall density and moment of inertia of the moon, which are incompatible. So I think we're seeing evidence for an internal fractionation of the moon in addition to any possible differences between the total composition of the moon and that of other objects in the solar system like the Earth and the meteorites.
Okay, we'll open it now for questions. Please raise your hand, wait for the mic, and whenever possible, identify the individual that you're asking the question to. This will be helpful for transcription purposes. Vic McElhaney.
Dr. Taylor, a lot of us don't follow the implications of all the details. Is there any evidence that emerges this morning for a moon that was molten for a significant length of time?
Do you mean the entire moon or partial? A partial melting?
Well, wriggle as you will.
My own feeling would be that the rocks, the Mare rocks we are looking at, show evidence of having been, that they clearly have been molten material. The question then comes, where is this material from? Is it produced by impact melting, or is it produced by conventional volcanic processes as we see on the Earth, from partial melting in the interior of the moon, and I mean partial melting, and then this material rising to the surface?
And is there anything now that distinguishes between those two possible origins?
I think you have to extend towards Apollo 12, in fact, the preliminary findings in Apollo 12, where we see an age difference between the Apollo 11 and the Apollo 12 material, indicating that the processes of Mare formation extend over a billion years.
Dr. Urey, I wonder if you could add some comments along that same general line. Time and time again in the past few days, we seem to have gotten an abundance of findings that would lead to either a partial or a complete molten moon, and then there is the Apollo 12 findings in terms of age. What conclusions have you drawn personally from this, and if any?
Well, first of all, I take all the potassium argon ages with a certain amount of doubt. I don't know whether the surface at Apollo 12 will turn out to be that age or not. I just don't know. Because of the very considerable amount of evidence that indicates that the moon has a very rigid structure, and that it's had a rigid structure for a long time in order to support the gravitational anomalies of considerable size that have been observed, it's very difficult to believe that the moon was melted in its early history or that it has been generally melted since. And I favor at the present time the view that there has been a layer on the surface of the moon that has been melted and differentiated. And I think there are little bits of evidence that indicate that this would solve some other problems, but I think there's no use in going into it in more detail until we have more data from other parts of the moon.
Dr. Urey, what process could cause such a melting in a layer on the surface?
Well, there are several. First place, Professor Hoyle suggested that the sun in its early age was a much hotter sun than it is now, and in that case it should melt the surface of the moon or any other objects that might have been present at that time. A second method is suggested by Dr. Sonnet, who says that there was an intense solar wind at the time, magnetic fields flowing out from the sun, and if you heated the surface mildly, it would become conducting and one would heat the surface, and the mild heating might have been done by collisions or something of that sort. Years ago, I suggested that perhaps the moon was formed originally in a great gas mask. In that case, you can accumulate it cold, and later, if you contract the gases, you can heat up the surface. There are several methods of melting of this kind that might be possible, and I rather think that the evidence for any one of these methods of melting is not very well substantiated.
And this difference between lunar matter and meteorites on Earth, how much the chemical effect of atmospheric combustion has been discounted?
Oh, I think that the effect of atmospheric combustion on the surface only of the meteorites that fall on the Earth are quite minor for the elements that I'm talking about in this case.
The heat does it not induce chemical transformation even deeper on?
The heat of entrance through the Earth's atmosphere certainly burns off some of the outside layer of the meteorite, but the speed at which it passes through the atmosphere and the thermal conductivity of the meteorite material is such that certainly the center parts of these meteorites that we get are not seriously affected. And certainly as far as the trace element composition, the elemental composition of these things, this isn't really a very important part of thing at all.
For Dr. Eckstein, one of the questioners from the floor yesterday threatened to produce today some hematite, mica, and various things that involved water in their formation. Is there enough interplay between the disciplines here so you know what he was talking about and how that would fit in with your findings?
Yes. As a matter of fact, he threatened to produce some clays, and I guess in deference to his suggestion, I didn't want to be too dogmatic about the absence of any water in the moon. Actually, as far as I can see, any contribution that water makes to the material that I get from the lunar sample, it's primarily due to the contamination of the terrestrial water. So this is one of the most difficult problems, is to get a pre-stained sample. And I'm not even certain that some of the water that the astronauts bring up with them in the moon does not play a minor role in adding some hydrogen to the lunar rocks. But this is conjecture, of course.
Dr. Clayton, or any of the members of the panel, in the last few days, we've heard varying discussions about whether or not the moon resembles meteorites or the moon resembles Earth, and according to which category of elements you look at, you get a different opinion. Is there any agreement as to which side is more accurate? Do they resemble the Earth, in fact, in more categories? Or does the moon resemble the Earth, or does the moon resemble meteorites in more categories?
Well, I think in comparison with, I'll only answer a part of this and let other people worry about others, but on questions, in comparison with meteorites, the question is all often put in the context of whether meteorites of one class or another are derived from the moon, or whether tektites are derived from the moon. And I think the sum of all of the types of chemical evidence seems to me to be overwhelming, that we see nothing coming to the Earth from outside that has come from the moon. We haven't identified anything yet. I think none of the meteorite classes, this of course assumes that the Apollo 11 data are in some way representative of more moon than we see. But none of the meteorite classes, and certainly the tektites, seem to be derivable from the moon. As far as the relationship between moon and Earth, if I just take the one little piece of evidence that we're concerned with, that is the oxygen isotope abundance. I mean, this is the most, of course, oxygen is the most abundant element in the rocks. We know that there are differences in different classes of meteorites, so that we expect that within the solar system, the various objects will have different oxygen isotope abundances. And what is found is that the abundance in the moon is indistinguishable from that on Earth. But also so are certain major classes of meteorites.
I think that nobody is looking, when comparing these meteorites, these different classes of meteorites with the moon, nobody is looking for an exact similarity. One is looking for evidence towards the processes that might have gone on in the mineral differentiation.
I don't see, Dr. Turkevich isn't here, and I haven't seen a paper or abstract of his. Was he here, and did he...
couldn't come.
Oh.
And sent a note saying that he would not be here. He's going to Europe soon, and is busy preparing to go to Europe.
So we don't know what he would have said.
No.
I see. Okay.
This is an old argument, but I think we have to review our thoughts on the core of the moon existence based on the strength. The results from the analysis of the lunar satellites give a strength of 10 bars with the existence of a core of 1/4 of the radius of the moon. And so I think that on basis of strength, we cannot rule out the presence of the core. Could you comment on this, Dr. Fury?
You see, there are two ways in which the moon is irregular. It has an ellipsoidal shape that is difficult to explain. Dr. Runcorn thinks there's convection inside the moon to account for this. Others, including myself, have suggested some variation in density that resulted in the form of its accumulation and things like that. Now, that's a large effect. Then there are the mascons, which are small things that are associated with the Great Maria. And at least I think, and I have some colleagues that I regard as much better authorities on the subject than myself, in fact, believe that these could hardly be supported unless there is a very strong external part of the moon. And if you start the moon off cold and heat it up, you can get a moon that has a strong exterior that might support these. The trouble is that it looks as though they were produced in the early history, and this means that at the time we're talking about, if you produce a molten moon, why, you would have lost your mascons at the very beginning and would have had nothing left to show for it. At least it looks that way to me at the present time. And by the way, there's going to be a discussion of it late this afternoon by a little party. Maybe I'm giving away some secrets, but there is going to be. I'm not going to be there, and I will be glad to see what the newspapers say about this, if they can get any report.
This is for Dr. Epstein, I guess. Whether or not any of your colleagues produce clay or any hydrate, you seem to be doing what I think a lot of the people are doing and saying, in effect, that you consider the Apollo 11 samples pretty representative of the moon. Do you, and if so, can you tell me why you think water or hydrates might not be found at some other point in the highlands or, say, on the backside of the moon or whatever?
Well, the reason why I think what I'm getting now is representative of the moon is because we're primarily sampling the solar wind, and we have nothing else to sample. Now, I hope very much if it's possible to get some hydrated minerals on the other side of the moon. As a matter of fact, when the astronauts first landed on the moon and said they saw biotite, I got pretty excited. But this is a hydrated mineral. But the only thing we can talk about is the thing that we have, and right now we have solar wind.
To follow up on that question, how about evidence of hydrates in the core samples, either on 11 or 12?
Well, I don't know of any presence of hydrated minerals in the core. I haven't gotten a sample of that type. The cores are not very deep anyway. I know that that's a very shallow depth on them. May I remark that gold and Popel suggested that water might be seeping from the interior of the moon and that it might be forming a permafrost layer and not be surface water at all. And Lingenfelder and Peel at University of California have suggested that the rills on the moon have been eroded under a layer of ice. Now, I haven't favored any of these views at all, but maybe we, in fairness, we should say that there are people that, before the samples came back, were thinking of methods by which some effects of water could have occurred on the moon that didn't involve an atmosphere of water on the surface of the moon.
This may be a very naive question for somebody that's been through high school chemistry, but you do have a considerable bulk of oxygen and hydrogen on the moon in reasonably close proximity to one another, and you've had a wide variety of temperature and pressure conditions there, apparently. And can you, as chemists, rule out the possibility that there'd be some combination between these atoms with all the action that apparently went on in the meteor impacts and this sort of thing?
Well, I don't know who's asking the question.
I'll throw it up for grabs.
Well, again, there's been a great deal of discussion about the origin of about water on the moon before any samples got back. And now we've got some samples, and we don't find anything that resembles water. And I guess you made certain assumptions in your question, the fact that there was water present and there was a lot of interaction. I thought you did anyway.
Can I say something?
The first
part of your premise is incorrect. There are not considerable amounts of hydrogen. And the amounts that are there, at least according to Dr. Epstein's interpretation, are derived perhaps entirely from the solar wind. But there are not considerable amounts of hydrogen, certainly not in comparison with any terrestrial rocks.
We're talking about parts per million, 20 parts per million of hydrogen. That's a very, very small amount.
How does that compare with the parts per million on
that? Well, there's a lot of water on the Earth.
2%.
In the rocks.
Yeah.
1 or 2%. Yeah, well.
No further questions, we'll adjourn.
I recall some years ago. I'm the last one on the list.
As a sub-co-line.
Okay, let's get started. We will follow the same procedure as we have on previous news conferences. If we could start with a gentleman on my far right, and if he could identify himself by name, affiliation, and talk some 2 minutes, or discuss 2 minutes the nature of his presentation this morning, and we'll sweep in from that point.
My name is Michael Duke. I'm with the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington. My talk this morning described the size distribution of material in the soil and interpreted for the whole lunar regolith or soil sampled by Apollo 11. The determinations were made by two techniques, and basically involved was actually counting grains. The distribution determined in this way is consistent with the photographic determinations of distributions of fragments on the ground in the vicinity of Apollo 11, and shows that the distribution is consistent with other Mare sites, and that the Apollo 11 site is finer grained on the average than other sites that have been investigated by surveyor by the photographic technique. The constituents of the soil are essentially this rock we call breccia, fragmental aggregates. Rock fragments are a minor constituent. The rock fragments that we find there are predominantly very fine-grained, apparently quickly cooled lavas that are not among those types that have been found in the bigger rocks. The people who have analyzed big rock fragments have not been looking at this same material. In broad conclusion, I have suggested that the bedrock at Apollo 11 is essentially this breccia, a fragmental rock welded by presently an unknown process, and that it is primarily the breccia and fragments contained in the breccia that are mixed in the lunar soil.
Milton Blander, North American Rockwell. Our PI was feeling ill, so I'm filling in for him. Blander. And our investigation was a Morsbauer spectral investigation of the lunar rocks and soils. There are essentially two major conclusions that we came up with. The first one is that this is an unusually reduced magma, meaning that there is a net deficiency of sulfur plus oxygen, and this was evidenced by the fact noted by other people that the mineral troilite, which is also found in meteorites, was present, and that the mineral ilmenite is unusual in either being stoichiometric, meaning there's an equal amount of iron and titanium, or perhaps even having an excess of titanium. There is a hint in our spectra that there is a slight excess of titanium in this ilmenite, which would hint at an unusual reduced state containing trivalent titanium in the ilmenite, or in effect, a partial solid solution of Ti-203, very slight amount of that. The other thing I think which is unique to the Morsbauer results is that we are able to integrate the total amount of iron in the samples, which you can't do microscopically because the iron is there, is present very often, and a lot of it, we believe, is present as very tiny grains, perhaps even down to levels of 100 angstroms, which you can still see with the Morsbauer spectra and count, in effect. And the of the total iron present in the samples, 7% of the total iron in the dust samples and the breccia, about 7% is there as metallic iron, which contrasts to about 1% in the rock. So there's a considerable excess of iron in the dust over and above what you see in the rocks. And of this, if we use the total nickel content of the dust as an indication of what fraction of that is meteoritic, to a first approximation, only half of that is meteoritic, and the other half comes from some other source, presumably from the reduction of either sulfide and or oxide by the cooking. If one cooks iron sulfide, troilite, at temperatures of, let's say, 1,500 degrees Kelvin, I don't know what that is, Fahrenheit, sulfur will boil off in a lunar vacuum quite readily. If one cooks an oxide at about 2,000 degrees Kelvin, iron oxide, it will boil off oxygen incongruently. And so there's the possibility, with the right time-temperature relations, that one could reduce the oxidized iron in the rocks to metallic iron, and both of these must have occurred.
I'm Elbert King from the University of Houston Department of Geology, and our group has been investigating the coarse fines material, the material in the size interval from 1 millimeter to 1 centimeter. We also have a volume of finer material, the same size material that Dr. Duke and his group have been investigating, but our work with that sample has not yet progressed very far. We've done examinations of 1,227 fragments, which is the total sample in this 5-gram portion of the coarse fines. The major conclusions that we've reached, I think you've heard many times before, and that these are mostly igneous rocks, either volcanic or shallow intrusive rocks, as far as the holocrystalline rocks are concerned. Among the holocrystalline rock fragments, though, there's some particularly interesting ones, of which we find some 30 odd pieces of a rock type called anorthosite. And this is not represented in the larger samples that were returned from Apollo 11. And I think you heard Dr. Smith and other people, and I think you will also hear John Wood this afternoon speculate as to what that may mean. But we concluded that it could have originated as the segregations or crystal cumulates in the Mare itself. However, from all the material that we've examined, it looks like our most likely possibility for lunar highlands material. And there's actually fair agreement between an anorthosite analysis and the surveyor highlands analysis. So we're hopeful that perhaps this is highlands material. We think that these coarse fines are one of the most interesting samples of the moon that we see from Apollo 11, because it has extremely great variety. We have a much larger variety of rock textures, modal analyses, or relative proportions of minerals that make up these rocks, and a much wider range of shock damage shown in these small fragments. They're polar mineralic fragments that are rock fragments, than we see in the large samples that have been returned. So for really determining something about the relative abundances and proportions of rock types present, this is an especially interesting sample. Just to point out one of the problems of sampling, many of the other people who have worked with this size range material find little nickel iron particles and meteoritic fragments of one kind or another. We didn't see any of these in our sample. It's just one of the things that I think Dr. Agrell referred to as the luck of the dip when you take 5 grams out of a larger aliquot of material. Another topic of some interest in past years, and it's probably becoming of considerably less interest after this conference, the subject of tektites. And we did not see any glasses that are similar to tektites. The isotopic chemistry of the moon, its major element chemistry is deduced from the Apollo 11 and 12 samples, make it seem impossible that tektites could originate from the moon. And I think that sort of summarizes our major thoughts.
My name is Carol Herzenberg. I'm from IIT Research Institute in Chicago. And our measurements have been largely MOSPAR spectrometry. You've already described much of the type of work that we've been doing. One of the unique features of our work has been that we've been developing scattering MOSPAR spectrometry so that we can work with rock chips or a whole lunar rock in a completely non-destructive fashion. We don't have to pulverize them. We can just shine our gamma rays on a whole piece of rock and find out what's in it. As you gather from what I said, this is a nuclear technique which permits us to identify a large number of the minerals which are present in the lunar rocks. And I hate to disagree with you, Albert, but we do see nickel iron.
Well, you did in your sample, we didn't in ours. That's just the way it goes some days.
And well, we've seen many of the other minerals which have already been described. This is an especially useful technique for picking out ilmenite, for example, and we've seen troilite, and metallic iron, which is apparently in the glass, as well as iron that is chemically bound in the glass, and also iron in the monoclinic pyroxenes, which I guess tektites is.
Well, my name is Fernandez Moran. I'm from the University of Chicago, and I reported preliminary results. This was a two-part presentation. Our work dealt with electron microscopy, with high-voltage electron microscopy. The electron microscope has considerably extended the range of direct visualization so that today we can actually see molecular and atomic structures in certain cases. Normal types of transmission electron microscopes required exceptionally thin sections. To be precise, you'd have to get layers of 100 atoms or so in order to be able to see them. But now with the advent of high-voltage microscopy, one can see with magnifications up to 1,000,000 times or more and can penetrate very thick layers. We applied this technique to a material known as pyroxene, which literally means fire stranger, for whoever's interested in etymology. And we were privileged to examine this thanks to generosity of a colleague of mine, Dr. Stefan Hafner, and Dr. David Virgo, who unfortunately are not here. When we looked at the lunar material, and I would like to emphasize this is very preliminary, by the very nature of our work, we examine only a small piece, a few microns on the side. So even if we work very hard, and we've barely had some 8 weeks to work on this, we cannot claim to have examined more than a very small area, so one must bear this in mind. Well, with these reservations in mind, we have found certain features in lunar pyroxene which are interesting. We don't know whether they're unique to the moon. The opinions are divided, but they are band structures, very regular band structures, which may reflect concentrations of certain of the components, iron, or may not. We still do not know. But the interesting part of the work is that it indicates how complex these silicates are, and they constitute about half of the material of the moon. They open up new fields for study, and there has been a considerable amount of excellent work done on the terrestrial pyroxenes. You will hear more about this from the experts. But we feel that this is encouraging, and with the note of caution that we must always inject, we intend to pursue it. Our main tool in preparing these rocks, incidentally,
is a device which uses a diamond knife. I developed this while working in Sweden. This is probably the sharpest edge known. You can split a hair lengthwise into 10,000 sections, so it's hair splitting of a certain degree, and that's the main tool we use.
My name is James Papike, and I'm at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, and I'm here with Malcolm Ross, so I'll just cut my talk in half with my comments. But the lunar rocks are mainly made up of three important minerals, feldspar, pyroxene, and ilmenite. Now, we concentrated only on the pyroxenes, and they turned out to be enough work for us. The pyroxenes make up about half the rock. They're the most abundant phase in the lunar rocks, and they're also the most complex. Now, this very complexity is what gives, I think, the lunar pyroxenes tremendous potential in terms of telling us about the thermal history of the moon and also about the volcanic or magmetic process. And so Mac Ross and myself, as well as many others, have looked at both terrestrial and lunar pyroxenes. We're happy with the complexity. We've identified and straightened out some of the complexity. And we could probably make some tentative conclusions, namely that the lunar pyroxenes do indicate a fairly rapid cooling of the volcanic rocks. We won't go into the complexity. Secondly, there's a feature. Because of the complexity of the lunar pyroxenes, they should probably have, or could possibly have, anomalous thermal expansion. Now, this should be investigated, because in the lunar surface, when we heat up and cool these rocks through the lunar day-night, this could be a significant factor in the lunar weathering, or the breaking up of the soil. So I simply encourage that the work be carried on to some high-temperature work on these pyroxenes and other silicates to see how this contributes to lunar weathering.
I'm Malcolm Ross of the U.S. Geological Survey in Washington, D.C. And my colleague, Jim Papike, has just commented on our particular work, but I would like to generalize on something I've observed in the last 2 days, and that's the cooperation between people in quite varied fields. For instance, Professor Fernandez Barand, to my right, has gotten into the electron microscopy of pyroxenes from what the biological field is.
Yes, essentially.
And we have people like Bentz, Weibland, Klein, and Boyd with the electron probe. I've been investigating pyroxenes with X-ray diffraction, and a number of other people have, Gabe, Bound, Brown, Long, and there must be 20 or 30 people somewhat overlapping, but we're coming up with the right answers, I think. We're not disagreeing on our measurements. Perhaps on our interpretation there'll be a bit of disagreement, but I think it's very refreshing, this cooperation between people in varied fields, and I think we're both learning from each other a great deal. And I also think with the high-voltage microscopy and the scanning electron microscopy, we've invented a new field of mineralogy at this conference, the study of very fine textures and minerals.
At this point, we'll open it to questions. Please raise your hands and wait for the mic.
Well, to go back, Mr. Papike, to these three major lunar minerals, I take it these are also minerals that are found on Earth to some degree. And I wonder if this commonality has any significance to you at all.
Is the question that they're also found on the Earth and what I make of this? Was that the sense of it? Well, the fact that they're also found on the Earth, I think, is to be expected, since we've also always known that the bulk composition of the moon or the surface of the moon, we always felt, was not that far off. So simply by the laws of physics and chemistry, we would predict that similar phases would occur. However, there are some interesting differences in rocks on the Earth that are similar to moon rocks, and that is that the feldspar, the plagioclase feldspar that we find, is fairly constant in composition. Now, in terrestrial rocks, it varies quite a bit more in composition, and this causes other changes in the magma and in the crystallization sequence that we get.
So there is this difference. I mean, although the same minerals are there, the difference in the degree of complexity is different. So we had a different, somewhat of a different process going on in terms of chemistry and perhaps other factors. Yes.
Ed DeLa, First Trust.
I wonder if one of you or maybe several of you would take it upon yourself to summarize what Jay's findings were. I don't see him here, and I don't believe we've got that paper.
Yes. He found three minerals in those rocks that are astounding: mica, amphibole, and aragonite. And this is aragonite.
Run through it for you again.
Mica, amphibole, and P-H-I-B-O-L-E. And these...
Aragonite.
A-R-A-G-O-N-I-T-E. A-R-G. The aragonite is calcium carbonate. The mica and the amphibole are very complex metal silicates, calcium, iron, magnesium silicate, and potassium, iron, magnesium silicate for mica. And the problem is water. Is there water on the moon? Now, the amphibole and mica, the terrestrial amphiboles and micas generally contain 1 or 2% water in the form of OH groups. I doubt if this is the case on the lunar sample, on the lunar rocks. It's probably fluorine rather than OH. So these are probably fluoromicas and fluoroamphiboles, but that's yet to be determined by Professor Gay.
I might, Jim Papike again, I might just comment on Mac's comments. And the fact is that one amphibole has been described in a meteorite, and that does turn out to be largely a fluorine amphibole. So this is entirely consistent with what you've said.
The OH, oxygen plus hydrogen, would be replaced by one fluorine atom. So it would be essentially an anhydrous fluorosilicate.
Harry Chase.
How about the aragonite? Why is that astounding?
Calcium carbonate is a sedimentary mineral. Of course, it does occur in certain meteorites. It seems unusual to us for a lunar sample, but I mean, we've just looked at one grab, so I'm sure we're going to be surprised with each new Apollo mission.
I don't think you mean to imply in this context that that was a sedimentary origin.
No.
Any further questions? All
right. What is the chemistry of an orthosite?
This is a rock composed almost entirely of plagioclase, and in this case, calcium-rich plagioclase. We didn't see these in the large pieces that came back from Apollo 11. These mostly had fair percentages, if not large percentages, of ilmenite and clinopyroxene with them as well. But a number of investigators now, I think at least four or five different investigators who are working with the finer particles have recognized this material and agree as to what it is. There's a possibility that this could be from the lunar highlands, and that's why it's especially interesting to us. We'd like to be able to know something about the highlands before we land men there and pick it up. It would be quite interesting to be able to prepare the astronauts, for example, to work in a geologically dissimilar terrain in which you're going to find different rock types. Now, there are other possibilities for highlands material, and we don't want to push the anorthosite too strongly because it's pretty speculative. All we can say is that we find some of it at Tranquility Base, but we don't find any big pieces, or perhaps this is just a chance sampling error. Maybe there were big pieces around and they just weren't picked up. We don't really know. Some of the meteorites, the eucrites, may possibly be Highlands material, and maybe Mike Duke would like to say a few words about that, since it's one of his ideas.
I prefer not, but we did make some other observations on the occurrence of what you might call an orthosite in the Apollo 11 sample. This was an observation that if you look at the soil that has diameters smaller than 10 microns, that is, soil that is less than 1 micron is 125,000th of an inch. 25 microns is 1,000th of an inch. These are fractions that are sub-10 micron diameter. There is a very large abundance of glass spheres compared to what we see at coarser sizes. You've all seen pictures of the nice spherical glass grains in these rocks. They are typically colored, amber, black, brown. But when you go down to the sub-10 micron fraction, there's a very large abundance of colorless glass spheres, and they have compositions that are also very rich in this mineral plagioclase. And we feel that because of the distinct size distribution of these, that they represent an exotic phase in the sample and quite possibly have come from quite some distance.
Do you feel that there's also a possibility that a fraction of this could be from just monomineralic fusions of micrometeoroids in the smaller grain sizes of the regular ordinary rocks of Tranquility Base?
I suspect not. The only evidence I can give toward it is that they are not monomineralic. They contain a little bit of iron and magnesium, and the ratio of the iron to magnesium is quite distinct from the ratio of iron to magnesium in the bulk rock.
The occurrence of concentrations of plagioclase in the Precioli finds might be due to probably also segregations in the fine grain rock, according to my observations. Essentially, we're doing the Mohs bar spectroscopy, so we are not supposed to report on this until probably later, if necessary. But my observations on some of the fine-grained basalt-like vesicular rock, even under the binocular microscope, you find certain patches that are almost completely devoid of pyroxenes and are almost completely composed of plagioclase. Now, if these are segregations and broken up, you might get the wrong interpretation that it came from someplace else. It probably is indigenous. What I mean to say that the anorthosite, the so-called anorthosite, are probably another explanation for them, are segregations within the fine grain rock.
There are certainly, if you go down to a glass bead that is 5 microns in diameter, there are many, many grains of feldspar in the lunar sample that are much larger than this. And the only question is, in my mind, is why there should be a very distinct size distribution for these. That is, these particular glass spheres are predominantly in this very fine grain size. And this is essentially two observations, a compositional observation and a morphological observation that bear on the question.
No further questions. We'll adjourn.